Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
I'm April Vokey, and you are listening to Anchored. My chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I sit down with my guests to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. Are you a member of Anchored Outdoors yet? If not, why not come over and check out what we've been up to? We recently published our full-length masterclass on streamers with Kelly Gallup, as well as one on baitfish with author and guide Kevin Veenstra. With 20-plus sequentially organized masterclasses from past guests of the show, we've proudly witnessed over 1,000 members achieve promising results and confidence on the water. Our upcoming classes are with world spaycasting champion Tim Arsenault. We will be diving all in on casting. I am so excited. I have got so many questions for him. As well as musky fishing with author and guide Rick Kustich. Find out more at www.anchoredoutdoors.com. I genuinely hope to get to know you better there. Millie Paney grew up mountain biking and rock climbing, taking up fly fishing in her mid-20s. A sought-after casting instructor, Millie co-owns Trout Hunter on the Henry's Fork. She resides near Last Chance, Idaho, enjoying both freshwater and saltwater fishing. Abroad, of course. In this episode of Anchored, we share personal updates and reminisce about past careers and experiences in the fly fishing industry. We cover the challenges and rewards of running a fly shop, the complexities of obtaining an outfitter license, and Millie's journey as a female ambassador in the industry. The conversation also touches on the evolution of Millie's business, the effects of climate change on local conservation efforts, and our comparison of why our daughters may prefer not to fish. Before we jump into today's episode, I wanted to quickly bring to your attention a particular piece of fishing gear that's been a game changer for me. I was tired of losing $100 glasses overboard and downstream, so like many of you, I started wearing Chums glass retainers to help limit the amount of glasses that we were losing in our family. Now, Chums has upped their game with their latest ripcord retainer system. Made from 3mm durable nylon rope, the cord is tough and reliable. But what's changed? Launching this week is their new interchangeable system that comes complete with two interchangeable ends, providing an ultra-wide range of fits for various sizes of glasses. The grippy silicone ends will not stretch out or lose their shape no matter how many adventures you take them on. These are launching for the first time right now, and I can attest that they've single-handedly made my life easier. Now a single set will work for either myself, my husband's chunky glasses, or my daughter's more slimline shades. Chums is all about embracing the spirit of adventure, founded on the Colorado River in 1983. They're for the guides, dirtbags, river rats, and weekend warriors. Committed to U.S.-based manufacturing and top-notch customer service, Chums has got you covered whether you're fishing in faraway lands or hiking in the backcountry. Check out their full collection of outdoor gear at chums.com. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you out there. Well, this is really cool. I'm excited. I feel like I haven't seen you in years, probably since we bunked together that time.
No,
like I definitely 10 years ago.
I was trying to remember how long ago that was. I have no idea. But yes, it was long, long ago before I had gray hair, I believe.
I think your hair looks fantastic. I just think you look great.
Thank you. Well, you do too. You always do.
Thanks. No, I think I was just married at the time, and Charles and I have been married 10 years now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And now, and how old is your daughter?
6. Yep. It happens fast. How old are yours now?
I just have one, and she is graduating from high school this year.
She is
in a month.
Not.
Yeah.
Oh my, because remember when we were bunking together, your dog had just passed away.
Yes.
And everything was.
Yeah, that was terrible. It was terrible.
Devastating. And you had a little one at home. I just remember.
Yep.
Yeah. Kind of watching your life with, you know, with the young family and being like, she's doing it and she's fishing and she's managing and she's coping and she can do it. I can do it. So, I mean, I thought.
So 10 years ago, she was 8. So a little bit older than yours is now. But yeah, it's kind of crazy having a kid and doing it all and hoping they want to jump in there with you.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if how's your daughter. Well, I think your daughter, I see your daughter doing things with you a lot and pictures of her with you.
Yeah. Now she's good. She was helping me skin a deer last night. That's what we were doing over the weekend. And a lot of questions about, you know, ethics and life and biology, mm-hmm. which we seem to mm-hmm. go through every rut. But, yeah, it goes fast.
Right.
But let's start pre-kids. So let's start with the very beginning of your story. So where were you born and raised?
I was born and raised in Moab, Utah.
Oh, okay.
Down in the desert. Yes.
Right.
Where there's no fly fishing.
Okay. What was your sport growing up before fly fishing?
I really got into climbing when I was in high school. And so that was really my thing. And also mountain biking. I ended up doing mountain bike tours in Moab and Sun Valley. And so biking and the climbing. I worked in the Wind Rivers, worked for kind of a small Outward Bound. And so we would take kids into the backcountry and, you know, hope they could survive.
Wait, so you did it professionally? Because for anyone who hasn't seen you, you're very fit, right? You've always been very fit. Is that where what it's from? Did you start climbing quite early? How did the whole outdoor pursuit thing start for you?
I mean, I think it was just growing up in Moab. Because have you been there? Or are you familiar at all? I mean, it's just the perfect desert, and there's. When I was little, my dad would always take us hiking, and we thought we were never going to find our way out of the canyons, but we always did. So I think, you know, it was just my parents taking me outside when I was young. But then, yeah, in high school, we had an outdoor ed program, started the climbing thing, and really loved that. Got into that. And also mountain biking. That's about when mountain biking was really taking off, or probably just starting up. And Moab was kind of just becoming, recognized, known then. So I just did those two things. And those were kind of always in my jobs. So just always outdoor stuff. When I was 23 and I was doing a mountain bike tour, and I bent over one morning to pick up a Dutch oven, loaded into the truck, and I ruptured some discs in my low back. And I lived with that until I was about 27. Then I had back surgery. And then that's when I was like, okay, I can't bike and climb for a while. I need a new sport. And I was introduced to fly fishing.
How? Who introduced you?
So I was in Sun Valley. It was my boyfriend at the time. And he had done some. And so he's like, hey, I want to get back into fly fishing. Let's do it. So I picked up a fly rod and I was so frustrated. It was the hardest thing I had ever tried to do. I just didn't get it. And I think that's why I kept doing it, because I just couldn't learn to cast and it was just pissing me off so bad. So that sort of grabbed me and, helped me through that first year. But then I loved the fact that I could just walk into a river by myself and have that outdoor experience where if I'm climbing, I need a partner. I fell in love with fishing because I could really be quiet and be there by myself.
Yeah.
So.
So now that's not your boyfriend turned husband. I'm assuming this is, a part of a past life.
So that was past life.
You went on to forge your own path. And where did it go from there? Where did you go from there? Did you move or were you still in Utah? No, you were in Sun Valley.
So that at that point I was in Sun Valley. So that's sort of where I started to fish on Silver Creek.
Oh, and amazing. Then,
yes. And so there's Silver Creek and Island Park. The Henry's Fork is about 4 hours from there.
Okay.
So we were kind of going back and forth and I was learning a lot of stuff. Split up with the boyfriend. And in the times we had come to Island Park, I met Renee Hara.
Wow. Big name.
Yes. Yeah. Which I didn't know at the time. I just thought he was this old guy, who was nice to me and like gave me flies and taught me things.
How did you meet him? Did you meet him on the river?
Oh, geez. I don't remember the first time I met him. It was either on the river or in the A bar. I don't know. Okay. And I really didn't know who he was. I had no idea. I knew nothing about fly fishing. I didn't know the history. I didn't know anything. He was great. I split up with the boyfriend and I was like, I want to be in Island Park. I want to be on the Henry's Fork. I want to learn to fish. So I called him up one day and said, hey, Renee, I hear you're opening a fly shop and I would like a job.
Oh, Millie.
Right?
Yeah, I like it.
Well, I didn't know who he was. I just thought he was some dude. And he said, okay, Millie, I'll put a good word in for you. And I mean, it had to have been super, super, super good because I knew nothing. I was terrible. Yeah, he put a good word in for me and Rich or John actually interviewed me. Very, very embarrassing, but for some reason he gave me a job.
So how many years ago was this then? If we're looking at your late 20s, early 30s, not you do not need to tell us how old you are, but we're looking at
29. It was 25 years ago.
Wow. Wow.
I know, right? I can't believe it.
Okay, so you start working at the fly shop. And at this point, because everyone who knows you knows that you own a fly shop now.
Yeah.
But at the time, yep. you're working there. And what
the girl in the fly shop.
But 25 years ago, the girl in the fly shop is a lot different than the girl in the fly shop now. So how was it for you working in the fly shop? Were you pretty well accepted or did you have the whole, hey, is John here?
I feel like I was pretty well accepted at that point. I had sort of been in Island Park and I knew a lot of the sort of locals and regulars that were coming into the shop and they were, they were great. They were helpful and accepting. And I'd kind of always worked with men in my jobs, mountain bike tours, a lot of men. Wind Rivers climbing, a lot of men. So it was always kind of, it felt normal to me. Yeah. So mostly it was fine. And of course, occasionally, and even still occasionally, I get the guy who walks in. He will ask me a question. I will start to answer, and he will immediately look to whatever man is standing next to me.
Right. Like,
okay, whatever, you know. So, yeah, it's just the way it is. But yeah, I think it was probably weirder for them than it was for me.
Gotcha. And then you had mentioned, I don't know if this is a Freudian slip or not, but you had said that Rich, and then you said John interviewed. Was Rich working at the shop?
Yeah. So originally, and that was the first year it opened, 99, when they hired me. So Rich and John had been working here. They came out as interns for the Henry Swark Foundation, and they worked as guides. And then Renee, Rich actually was like, I can't be a guide forever. I'm going to go back to law school, do something else with my life. And Renee approached him and said, hey, there's an outfitter's license for sale. Would you like to go into business with me? Right. And he said, sure, as long as I can have John along.
Right.
And so it was Renee, Rich, and John.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Now, I know, and again, people who know, you know that Rich is your husband.
Yep.
So talk me through the timeline of the shop. So you start working at the shop, you are settling in, and what happens next?
Oh, geez. Settling in. April, this is a boring story.
You fall in love and get married? You go fishing, you fall in love?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. I moved here, and actually the first summer I was here, I was like, I'm buying a house. Okay. I'd saved up some money, put a down payment on a house, got a little cabin here. And Rich and I kind of hit it off and started dating, and I don't know, it worked fine. We worked well together. I remember he would get really mad. You know, he would ask me to do something. I'm like, I'm not scrubbing the toilet. You scrub the toilet. I'm making you a shit list. And then he'd go upstairs and write out his list. Come down and be like, do this, you know, shit list. But yeah, it worked. And so we dated, a few years before he proposed, and then we got married in 2003, which is the same. So we started in a little tiny building on one side of the highway, then bought property across the highway on the river, built the lodge, opened it in 2003, and got married that summer also. Whoa. At the lodge. Yeah. Yeah.
So sorry, didn't mean to cut you off, but the lodge, did that predate the shop then?
So the it started as just a fly shop, and then got property on the river. And so now we have we have rooms, fly shop, guide staff, and then restaurant, bar and grill.
Oh my gosh, you guys have taken it to the next level.
Well, yeah, a long time ago we did. You should come out here and see it.
You haven't sold it, right? You still have it?
No. Oh, yes. Yeah. No. Yeah, Trout Hunter is up and going.
What were the main struggles getting started? Now, did you guys have to break free and start your own shop from Renee?
No.
You took over the shop?
He was just part of the business. He was part of the business. He never, he was never in the shop, because he's Renee, and he had his own stuff. He and his family tie flies, like the most amazing flies, dry flies on the planet. So he had that business. So we were lucky we had his name. So that kind of gave us credibility. And so slowly we built the business, and we had a few guides, and they were great. so yeah, we just slowly grew. And then, yeah, got the property and expanded. Yeah.
As you do. And then did you guide? Did you do any guiding?
No.
Why not?
I think, you know, at one point when I first got into fishing, I thought that I wanted to. I don't know why I really didn't. I think that I just kind of got pulled into the shop and my role there and enjoyed that. I also had a lot of injuries.
Right.
I'd had back surgery, low back surgery. Mm-hmm. So like right before we opened, I think I was 27 when I had back surgery. And so, you know, I know how strenuous rowing a boat is. And yeah, I've had two knee surgeries. I've had surgery on my neck. So I think that it just like, I'm like, I'm going to kill myself if I try to do that. It's insane what I watch these guides do all summer, how hard they have to work. So it was just nothing that I was ever really pulled to do. What I do end up doing a lot of is teaching. I teach a ton of casting, and whatever you want. If you want to, you know, learn knots or whatever, do that. But I started teaching casting, and I love it because most of the people that come into the fly shop aren't going on guide trips. They can't go on guide trips. They can't afford it. But they want to go fish and they just need some help. They need help picking out bugs. They need help knowing where to go. They need help casting. You know, and when I first started fishing, I couldn't go on guide trips. There's no way. I was broke. And so I was always looking for people like, can you teach me to cast? Can you teach me to tie a knot? Can you teach me this? So, you know, I remember that. And I know there are so many people like that. And I love helping those people. And I love being on the water by myself. And so I want to, you know, encourage that in people and help them enjoy the river and fishing in that way.
Yeah.
So.
What were some of the, as a business owner, I'm just thinking for people listening who would like to follow in your and Rich's steps, because from the outside looking in, it looks like a dream come true. I mean, two anglers fall in love. They've got a fly shop, they expand, they have a family. It's perfect. What were some of the big obstacles though? Because it couldn't have just been all butterflies and roses. And professionally, I'm not prying personally, but professionally, what were some of the obstacles in doing the sort of business that you were doing or being in the industry and expanding in the way that you did?
Oh my gosh, obstacles. I don't remember any like huge, like, oh my God, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
It's been really relatively easy. I mean, we worked hard. We went to shows and, you know, we built the business slowly. We've always had great guides. We've have a great staff that comes back year after year after year. I push back from maybe other local shops that weren't so excited about us opening a business. That was maybe a big one early on.
They settle in. Everyone gets settled in. What about now? If someone were to try to do it now, what do you think would be the biggest problem? I automatically think real estate prices.
Yeah.
Would that be the big deterrent?
Yes. Real estate prices, outfitter license. I can't imagine. I have no idea if you wanted to buy an outfitter's license, what you'd have to pay for, pay for it now.
How does that work in America? In Canada, you're a guide and you get your guide license and you pay through an association and you have to have a certain liability and you know, insurance. But in America, mm-hmm. I always hear people talk about outfitter licenses. And I think about Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, Colorado. It always sounds very extreme. What's it like to get an outfitter? What is an outfitting license? It lets you have assistant guides under you?
Also, it's different in Idaho than it is in Montana. In Montana, you can go, you can get your guide license, you can become an outfitter, and you can, and everybody can be a guide, or, you know, it's insane up there, the way it's managed. In Idaho, there are a limited number of outfitters licenses on whatever river. And here on the Henry's Fork where we are, there are three, four maybe. So you have your outfitter's license, you have a river. Rivers divided into sections. And in each section of river, you can only put so many guides. And it's about three.
Oh, okay.
So yes. So that kind of limits us as to how many guides we can have, which I think is great, because then we know we have 12 solid guides. We can put them on 15 solid stretches of water. I think it's managed really well here in Idaho. The resource is very stressed. Everybody's and their dog has gotten into fly fishing recently, as you know. So there's so many people out there. But I think Idaho does a good job of trying to manage outfitters and guides and, you know, that.
I'm assuming, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but back to Canada, because that's the only real experience I have. Because guiding in Australia is a whole different world. Apart from insurance, it's pretty much like Montana. It's kind of the Wild West. But in Canada, mm-hmm. especially in northern British Columbia for steelhead, there are a set amount of guided days or angler days that you can buy. So I'm assuming, let's say that there's four, you said four outfitting licenses?
Yeah, three or four on whatever section, yeah.
They can be sold or passed down because they're not, yes. I'm assuming they're not making new ones anytime soon?
Correct, yes.
So the price on those would just be starting to skyrocket, are they? Or I'm assuming they don't sell for the same price every generation. They must be going up.
I would think so. I have no idea. I think when Renee bought the, I don't know what Renee and, you know, Rich paid for the license back then, but I know that it didn't break the bank. It was reasonable enough that, you know, they could start a business and feel like they could survive. I think about it now. Rich and I are 53, and of course we're not going to work forever. And then what if we sell the business? Like, I wonder who could actually purchase it that would take care of it, you know? Because we were young and passionate and it was going to be our future. But now you have to be a millionaire, I don't know, to get an outfitter's license and do the whole thing. I don't know where it goes.
It's going to be interesting to watch. So let's backtrack mm-hmm. then. So you've got the shop, you've done this beautiful expansion. You guys decide to have a family, I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason why I'm bringing this up, because anyone who's eye rolling right now, because they're like, April, she's a woman and you're asking her that because she's, no, it's not. It's because you have got a story that I have tried to tell so many people and I it's been so long since I've heard it. I can never get it right. And I'm wondering, it's a little personal, but I'm wondering if you would share the dolphin story for us.
Yes, the dolphin story. So Rich and I decided to have a kid. And we're like, okay, we'll try for like a year. Because I was 32. So I said, okay, I don't want to have a kid when I'm really old. So I'll give it a year. And if it doesn't happen in a year, then we're done. So it had been about a year and we were on a trip in Belize fishing and I wasn't pregnant and I didn't feel pregnant. I felt fine. I was just doing my normal fishing thing. And we were out on the boat and we saw these dolphins, this, you know, pod of dolphins or whatever you call them. And I'm like, hey, Dubs, can I go swim with those dolphins? And I was totally joking at the time. And he said, sure, yeah. So I put on my snorkel and my fins. I jumped in the water and I was just swimming with them, like close, like I could almost touch them. And I got out of the boat or got out of the water and got back in the boat. And Dubs said, Millie, those dolphins were acting kind of strange around you. And I'm like, what? He's like, are you pregnant? I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm like, I'm not pregnant, Dubs. He's like, I don't know, Millie. Okay. So finished the week. We flew into Salt Lake in the middle of the night, drove home. I woke up the next morning and went, bleh! And I was like, I'm pregnant. And we're just like, no, you're not. I'm like, I've never felt this way. I'm pregnant. And I was pregnant.
They knew.
Yep. He said they act differently. When like when a female dolphin is pregnant, they'll kind of huddle around her and
like protection, you think? Some sort of guard?
I have no idea. I don't know. So yeah, that's the dolphin story.
I love it. I have tried telling that story so many times that I always get it wrong. Okay, so then from there you raise a family, you've got the shop, you've got the lodge, you've got everything going on. How do your ambassadorships come together? Because this predates influencer times, right? So did you?
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. And so it's very organic. It's back in the day when I was,
yes.
I don't know if you know, I'm no longer with Patagonia. It sucks, but it.
Boo.
Boo. Yeah. And so, but that all happened organically before influencer days. And so sitting with Yvonne and talking about waiters and stuff. So how did your relationship start? Because I don't know about the Scott relationship, but I know that Patagonia would have started before all the Instagram selfies.
Yeah.
So what's the story there?
Again, I was just young and dumb enough to be bold. we were carrying Patagonia's brand.
Right.
And I think that Patagonia did have some ambassadors and somehow I stumbled across it. And they didn't. Oh, no, you were an ambassador then. I think you were the only one. And then there were a few men. And so I just called up our rep or whoever I needed to. I'm like, why do you only have one female ambassador? I want to be an ambassador. They're like, okay, let us get back to you on that.
I didn't know you're so bold. I'm loving this. I love this, Millie. Keep talking.
No, I was just dumb enough to be bold. Then, I don't know, 6 months later or something, they called me up. They're like, hey, want to be an ambassador? So, of course, I said yes.
Yeah, I love it. Are you finding that as you're getting older that you're being taken more seriously in fishing?
Yeah, I mean, of course, yes, but no, also. Like we were just on a trip in Cuba and went to this new area that we'd never been to. So the guides didn't know me or Rich. And I got up on the deck to cast and he was like, whoa, women usually are not very into fly fishing, but you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
But so You know, I got on the boat, and of course he's thinking, you know, she's going to sit there and watch her husband fish all day. But then, you know, once you start, then yeah, they take you seriously.
But in the fishing industry, forget, you know, the standard Joe Blow, but in the fishing industry, are you finding that by holding your ground and just aging gracefully, I cannot believe how great you look. You look fantastic. That it's, you're starting to just find your footing better. And I'll let me give you some context. I can't tell if I've been more accepted in the fishing industry because A, I don't know what people are saying that's bad anymore because I just try not to listen. B, if it's because I am getting older and therefore people are just used to me now, in my 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Or C, if it's that the whole world and the entire industry has changed to be more accepting, mm-hmm. or if it's a mix mm-hmm. of all three of those things.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's definitely a mix. And you know, there are so many more women in it now.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And I felt like, you know, it took off slowly, but then it just skyrocketed.
It did, right? That's how it felt.
Yeah.
What caused that?
I don't know. Was it pre-COVID? Or yes. Was it around COVID?
Oh, I don't know. I wasn't in America. I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, it's the same, you know. Yeah, I felt like women just skyrocketed at some point. And it's all kind of a blur to me. So I don't remember how long ago that was.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it wasn't that long ago. But I feel like the fly fishing industry has accepted us. Like, they know we're here, they know women fish, and they've made a space for us. And maybe like the old curmudgeon-y guys that were fishing when no women are fishing, maybe they're all then gone, and so that pushback is gone. I don't know.
Could be.
But yeah, I think it's everything. I think you get a little older and you're like,
yeah.
I don't know what they're saying. I don't
yeah.
care. I'm just
so true.
Yeah.
Well, you're in a very unique, not unique, so maybe, yeah, unique. You're in an age that I am questioning, or you're at the age where I'm questioning kind of where I'm going to be feeling in the industry. Like, are you going to want to, what do you do with it? Because in your 50s now, because you said your early 50s, right?
Yeah.
Which is your same age as my husband. And that's why we have a lot of these conversations, and I can kind of look ahead and seeing what he's going through with his career. You get to the age where you're taken seriously, and especially as an educator, because you've learned so much over the last, you know, couple decades. Think about how much you've learned teaching now compared mm-hmm. to, you know, 20 years
mm-hmm.
ago.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
you can actually sell out spaces and really, promote your skills as a teacher, mm-hmm. or you can start to take a step back and become a little more private and quiet and quote unquote retired. What's your plan for within the next 10 years?
Oh, geez.
Are you going Joan Wolf going to be teaching until you're 90, or are you going to totally disappear and, you know, Ed Ward just do your own life?
I will always be involved. I guess it depends on what happens with our business, and I can't imagine selling it or passing it off for somebody else. It's like your baby, you know, like, and you're like, nobody will love this like I do. Yeah. So I can't imagine ever leaving it, but I also can't imagine doing this for the next 20 years, you know? So I kind of think, I don't know. I'm sure that Rich and I will not be as involved at some point in the future. You know, we'll talk about hosting more saltwater trips, things like that. I love to travel, and I feel like I do get to travel. I'm pretty lucky with the places that I've been able to go and see. But of course, there's more I would like to see in different ways. You know, I love just getting in a car and driving and seeing, you know, the landscape and the whole country. So I haven't been able to do that. We fly away and we are in the middle of the ocean somewhere.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I answered your question.
You did. It sounds like you want to do everything. Is there somewhere that you haven't been yet that you really want to be for fishing purposes? So a fishing trip you haven't taken yet?
Sure. I mean, I haven't done like the Dorado thing.
Oh, yeah.
I've done the steelhead thing.
What do you think? What did you think of the steelhead thing? You hurt my feelings.
No. I loved it. So when I first got into fishing those first couple years, when I was in Sun Valley, with the ex, he wanted a steelhead fish. So I'm like, great, let's try steelhead fishing. So I learned to spay cast, and it was, oh my God, oh, that was another frustrating time. but I loved it. We went to BC and I was on the Kispee Ox and the Copper. I loved those two rivers a lot. And the Clearwater. We did stuff on the Clearwater. And back then, you know, I was tougher. I didn't mind being freezing cold, standing, you know, up to my boobs in water. And so I thought it was great. I loved it. Then I got involved with Trout Hunter and our off season came around. I'm like, hey, Rich, let's go steelhead fishing. And he's like, no, let's go saltwater fishing. I'm like, okay, I could do that. So yeah, we sort of, you know, ventured into the whole saltwater thing.
Do you have a species that you prefer in saltwater fishing?
I think I don't prefer permit.
Okay.
I know that everybody wants to catch permit. I think it's the most miserable thing you can do.
So does Charles. I mean, my husband hates them. He will bowl cast at mullet trying to get up on a permit. He's a bastard. And so why? I mean, no. I know they're hard, but do you keep to anyway, I don't want to interrupt you. Tell me why.
No, I mean, I will definitely permit fish, I think it's Rich's thing. Like he loves it. That's his thing. He needs to catch that permit. And I'm just like, okay, you do that. And then when it's my turn, I'll give it a shot. But man, you know, you stand up there for hours and you're standing and it's hot and you're sweating and your mind drifts off and then there's a fish and you've got to cast and you know how it is.
Yeah.
It's a pretty brutal fish and, you know, and then you get up there and I blow a cast and Rich is like, well, wasn't that fun? I'm like, no, that was not fun at all. There was nothing fun about that. I'm like shaking. I've caught permit and once you catch one, yeah, then it's fun. Tarpon are great fun, of course. Okay. They just love to eat. They jump. They're super fun. Bonefish are fun. I'll kind of do it all. I'll do anything.
What has saltwater fishing done to you or done for you as an angler?
It made me a better caster. It helped me see the world. Mm-hmm. I always wanted to travel, so it let me travel. I appreciate my life and what I have a lot more because of the places I've been able to see and go. I think that that's probably the biggest thing that it's done. It's a reality check, and it really does make you go, man, I'm lucky.
Yeah.
I've got a good life.
Thankful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does your daughter fish?
No.
Yes. Okay. Talk to me. What do I do? I swear it's because I've taken her fishing so much. She doesn't want to, she likes going on the water. She likes rowing boats, but I think I've ruined it and I don't know what to do. I don't know how to go back.
Yeah. I don't know what to tell you because my daughter doesn't like to fish. Maybe I should call her it.
Yeah. Right. Put her in the call.
No, when she was young like that, she would go out with us and she would have a great time and we would catch fish and, you know, catch one to keep for dinner and she'd break their neck and she thought that was great. And then she got older and just sort of drifted away from it. I tried not to be super pushy.
Yeah.
Rich, pushy. He, you know, thought she was going to be the next Joan Wolf or whatever. But I also think, I mean, when I was little, I didn't want to be anything like my mom.
That's right.
I wanted to do my own thing. I wanted to be my own person.
Yeah.
And maybe that's it.
And I think so.
Sorry.
That's making me feel so much better because, you know, you start wondering as a parent if you've done something wrong. I know we were never pushy. But she also understands my career. And I think she's just so desperate to not be anything like me, which is kind of offensive. But my mom was a professional. My mom's a professional horse rider. I didn't want to be anything like my mom. I didn't want anything to do with horses because of that. So,
yeah.
And I love my mom and I admire my mom, but I didn't want to be my mom.
Yeah. Well, would you want to go deal with horses now?
Not really. No.
No.
Not particularly.
But you have more appreciation for what your mom did.
I do. Yes.
Her life. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's fun. I always feel like this big fraud because everyone reaches out and says, how do I get my child into fishing? And I'm like, I don't know. You figure it out and tell me because I've got a really good, the only person I know who's really done it and had their child really step up. Kind of, I think, to the level of or the caliber that we all kind of fantasize our kids will make it to, is somebody who denied their, I don't want to say his name because I think this is a little harsh, honestly, but would not let his son go with them ever, like growing up till he was 13 or 14 or something like that. And only then did he say, okay, now you can come out with me for a little bit here. And he was extremely harsh on him. And now that kid is one of probably one of the best anglers I know. And so he was done by just brutal tactics. You know, I'm going fishing all day.
Reverse psychology.
It was done with reverse psychology. Yes. And I just don't want to play mind games with my family.
Right. Right. Yeah. I just wanted her to be outside. I just wanted her to be outside and just, you know, get to know the outdoors.
Yeah.
And she did admit to me the other day that she would like to get a little more into fly fishing.
Oh, it comes back around. Uh-huh. Okay.
Yes. Yes. And she's going to college in Virginia. To Washington and Lee, which is actually where Rich went to college, and John. And it's, oh my gosh, I'm so excited for it. But they have great outdoor programs and a fly fishing club and all sorts of clubs. So she's like, yeah, I. And she knows, like, I think when she was 10, I was like, she was still kind of into it. And I'm like, I'm going to teach you to double haul. She's like, okay. Boom. 30 minutes later, she's double hauling.
Yeah.
So she knows stuff. She could like it. Well, if she really gets into it, she will pick it up fast because she knows. She knows it, you know?
Yeah.
But you can't push it on.
Has she expressed any interest in taking over the family business?
Yeah. Once when she was like, when she was, I don't know, 7 or 8.
Oh, okay.
She's like, Mom, what's that thing Dad does? She said, I want to work at Trout Hunter when I grow up. I was like, okay, well, when you start, if you really get into fishing and learn fishing, you can work in the fly shop with me to start, or you can work in the restaurant if you want to start hosting, or, you know, working in the kitchen, you can do that. She's like, no, I don't want to do that stuff. What does Dad do? What's it called that my dad does? I'm like, he's the boss. She's like, that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
I want to be the boss, Mom. Yeah. And she was little, like 8 or something. Yeah. so then she did. Now I think she, I don't know that she knows what she wants to do at all.
Yeah.
And that's okay. And maybe she'll come back and I don't know. I mean, that's a concern of mine, because who else is going to take it over?
Oh, I'm sure you'd find somebody. Do you manage that many people? Do you manage restaurant staff and everything?
Yes. So we have 12 guides. I don't know. 8 or 10 fly shop people. A dozen wait staff. I think we have maybe 60-ish employees in the summer.
Oh, that sounds horrible. Sorry, that's just terrifying to me. Who manages them all? Are you in charge of managing, or do you have a manager who manages wait staff and manager who manages?
It sort of changes year to year. Like, we've had managers in the restaurant. Right now, we don't have an official manager, so Rich and John are kind of dealing with that. Because the fly shop and guide staff, we've been doing it long enough that everybody knows their part and everybody does their job really well. So there aren't many fires to put out.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's amazing.
It's really good. We have a great staff. And the restaurant is the restaurant. Restaurants are just crazy. So I think that's the hardest part of the business.
Yeah.
But we're really lucky there too. We've had a staff that just comes back year after year after year. So that makes it a little easier.
So you guys shut down for the winter?
Pretty much. The fly shop is, we're always in the fly shop. The restaurant and rooms are open. It's pretty slow. It's snowmobile season here. So we get some snowmobilers, but Island Park is 30 miles long, and it's amazing how different it is from the north end to the south end. And the snowmobilers kind of always end up at the north end. We're kind of unknown, still unknown. We don't really push it for them, but we're open. We're open. We keep the restaurant going, keep people working. And actually right now we're closed. It's mud season. So everybody's getting a little break right now.
Yeah. Good. What do you think you're best known for in fishing, or what do you think is your best strength? Do you think your best strength is an instructor, a trout angler, saltwater angler? Cause I'm going to rapid fire a couple questions at you before we wrap it up.
I have no idea what I'm best known for.
What do you, let me rephrase, forget best known. In your mind, what do you see yourself as? For example, I see myself as primarily a steelhead angler, who has now obviously expanded by moving part of the year to Australia. And someone, I'm very proud of the fact that I can do everything, spay cast, single hand cast, saltwater, all the things. And that's kind of this box I put myself in. It's rather than be an expert in something specifically, I feel like I'm a very well-rounded angler in all aspects. What do you see yourself as?
I hope that I'm a good teacher. And I mean, I really love it when people come to me and they want to learn and I can help them. I love that. I love helping people get into this sport if they want to. I think I'm a pretty decent caster. I think I'm, you know, I do okay. I can hold my own saltwater fishing. But yeah, I hope that people see me as welcoming. Because I know that, you know, if you're new in the sport, it can be very intimidating going into a fly shop or asking for help or, you know, where do I go for instruction? So, yeah, I hope people, I don't know.
Learn something.
Just know that I'm open to helping.
So with that in mind, let me rapid fire a few questions at you. What is the number one error that you see people, beginner anglers, come to you with, casting wise specifically?
What do I see them doing? This.
Arm extension?
Yeah. The straight arm, the elbow up in the air. Yep. They love to do that.
Where do you take them from there? Do you have some sort of strategy? Like, do you start with their stance? Do you start with their grip? Do you start with their body rotation? Where do you typically start? Or is it just dependent on their own style?
A lot of times I'll watch them be like, okay, here's what we need to fix. But no, I think I start with, here's what you need to do. Elbow up, elbow down. Keep it bent. Elbow up, elbow down. But yeah, I everybody's really different. So I just have to see where they are. And then we go from there. But it always goes back to elbow up, elbow down.
So somebody comes in, they're brand new to fishing and they come into the shop. They've just had a lesson with you. What do you sell them? Do you sell them a fast rod, a medium rod, a slow rod, a bamboo noodle? What do you think is best for somebody who's listening right now, who wants to get into fishing? You know, you see the client come in before, what do they need?
I do not like really fast rods at all. Do you?
No.
Nope. No. really slow rods?
Depends. I do like a bamboo. I like something I like something where I can feel the sole. I like a lot of the old Lumas. Yeah. I love Scott. I do love Scott. So
yeah, I love Scott. Yeah. I like something that you can feel. I try to teach people to feel that rod. So fast ones and slow ones, I feel like if you like that, then yeah, do it. But you need to really know what you're doing.
They're not always practical from a fishing stance.
Right. And be committed to that. So yeah, I like sort of a medium fast action rod, but I will, you know, I'll take two or three rods out and be like, try these, see which one feels best. Or yeah.
As a shop owner,
which one feels best?
Are dollars indicative of quality? Can you get a relatively inexpensive rod that's going to be a quality rod, or something that is that where you can actually feel that it's got the right energy transfer?
Yes. Yeah, you can. Is it the NRX, the Lumas NRX? That's one of the Lumas rods. Yeah, we have a couple rods that are, I mean, I don't know what's expensive. I know rods now are $1,000. $500 is like a cheap rod anymore.
Oh, really? US?
I mean, I think if you're starting, you want to plan on spending about that much on a rod if you want to get something decent. That you're going to enjoy for several years.
Right. Not just
that you're not going to outgrow. Yeah.
What about the $200 TFO rod reel line combos. Do those still exist? It's been also 20 years since I've worked in a fly shop.
Yes, they do. There are some combos. We don't really carry them.
Yeah.
We kind of piece things together for you. Yeah, because you can get a cheaper reel to go with a more expensive rod, or a cheaper rod to go with a nicer reel, and put something together that works with your budget.
I love what you said about pricing out a package, you know, maybe having a less expensive reel, but having the quality rod, because you're right. A lot of new anglers outgrow their rods. Mm-hmm. And that's disappointing, because yes, it was $200, but you've outgrown it now in 6 months. And now that was $200 you didn't have to spend. You could have just spent the $500, like you said.
Yeah.
And been better off from the beginning.
Yeah. And yeah, it's hard to explain that to people when they're first starting, because they don't, they can't feel the difference between this rod and that rod. But yeah, I don't want to push anybody into something that they don't need just so that we can make more money. I truly want people to be happy and understand, or, you know, be happy with what they're getting. And understand that things will change. They might outgrow it. You can put it on eBay.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's important.
And upgrade.
It is important to note, because I think a lot of people don't realize that they will outgrow or could potentially outgrow their rod. So I'm happy that we covered mm-hmm. that, as awkward as that may have been, because I hate talking money on the show. But it is important, because it's a major deterrent for a lot of people who want to get into it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. It is. Like I said, eBay is amazing. You can go on there and get a lot of great deals. And Rich might kill me for saying that. But it's just like, so I charge $50 for an hour casting lesson, mm-hmm. and I have forever. And people are like, why don't you raise your prices?
Yep.
And I'm like, because when I started, I don't even know if I could have afforded a $50 casting lesson. So I want people that are on a very tight budget to be able to do this. Yeah. So. Yeah.
How did you guys manage pivoting and accepting and working with the internet and online sales?
Oh, geez. Well, we're terrible. We are absolutely terrible.
But you sell online, right?
Yes. Yes, we do. We do. We have trouthunt.com and our store there, but we're busy enough with everything else that it's kind of been neglected, and nobody that works for us is really good at it, okay. at dealing with that. But we just hired someone who's going to be revamping our whole online presence, our exciting. Online store. So yes, so that'll change.
Yeah. Okay. But, that's great to hear. Yes. Yeah. I'll link the website and the store and everything in this episode. Okay, cool. Is there anything professionally or personally that I've missed about you and your timeline? I feel like you're right in the middle of it still. There's still a lot more to your story that needs to be told.
I feel like my life is pretty boring. I mean, for people to listen to, you know, my life is not boring. I have a great life and I get to go do fun things. But no, I mean, my life is just pretty normal. I get up in the morning, make my kid breakfast, send her to school.
Love it. Okay. Yeah. I know I've missed a million questions. I'm trying to think of what else I can ask you. A lot of them are just professional about owning the shop. But again, I don't want to bog you down with too many questions. I've got one last question about inventory and fly shops and how it works. How does it work with discounting prices? Are you guys not allowed to discount prices through a manufacturer?
No. There's a standard price on your inventory that, yeah. That's what it is.
You're not allowed.
And then toward, no, you're not supposed to. I'm sure
people,
some people do. And then, yeah, if something is discontinued, boom, goes on sale. Toward the end of the season, that's a good time to find things because, you know, whatever, the Patagonia fleece jacket color changed, and so it's on sale.
Oh,
and same
okay.
with rods. So, yeah, same with rods. So this one is no longer, getting rid of it, on sale.
Yeah, and when does that happen? I'm just, because I'm thinking about all the questions I get from newbie anglers who want to get into it, but it's too expensive. So you said the fall is a good time to do that?
Late fall is a good time to go into your fly shops and see what you can find.
Right. Okay. Is it worth asking for a deal? I'm assuming you guys must get exhausted with people asking for pro staff deals or guide discounts.
Well, only guides and staff get, you know, deals, get those pro staff deals. And then, people really, I feel like, don't ask. It's like, it's the end of the season when people know, they know, okay, this is the time of year that I can go in and now I can ask for a deal and I'll probably get one. But
right.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Say no more, because I don't want you to be pestered, but I do love the honesty and I think it's helpful for people who want to get into it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Do you have any words of advice or closing words for a newbie angler? Because I think you're the perfect person for someone to come and see. You really, you've got it all. You've got the right demeanor. You're a teacher. You've got the shop. You're clearly honest. Do you know what I mean? You've got that chill vibe about you, but you're bold enough to just say it for what it is. You're the perfect person. If someone is local, they would be mad not to go in. But to people who can't meet you in person, is there anything that you would want to pass on that's just kind of a word of wisdom for someone who wants to get into it and is feeling a little lost?
Don't be scared. Don't be like, I know, people have said it's, I'm eating my hair, that it's intimidating going into fly shops. Especially women say that. And I get that, but if you go into a fly shop and there's some guy behind the counter and he's being a jerk, leave and go find another one, because I feel like the industry has grown enough that they know women are out there and we want to do this and we will spend money on it. So yeah, if you go somewhere and somebody's a jerk, go find somebody else, go find another shop, because you're going to find that place where, you know, you're accepted and supported and helped and, you know, all your questions can be answered and you, you know, aren't talked down to.
Yeah, it's so true.
Don't be scared. Yeah.
Good one. And also, and give some time. It's funny. My favorite archery shop here in Australia is shit. I mean, they never have the stock. Their people always suck. I get talked down to all the time. And then I'll swear I'm never going back in.
Well,
and
it's probably because they hear you say stuff like that about them.
But you know, I've never said it out loud and I won't say their name, but they've got this guy in there now named Jay. And Jay has got me for life. I will never leave that store. As long as Jay is in there, I will be there, because I am that new person with all these questions. I mean, I'm not new to archery, but I'm new enough. It's only been, you know, a decade. It's not very long in the grand scheme of things. He answers right. my question. I will sit there for 2 hours and I will ask him every question about arrow spines and the velocity and, you know, razor, everything that I could possibly think, because he's so knowledgeable. And I would never have found him if I didn't give the shop another chance.
Yeah.
So I do want to just make it clear that sometimes it's worth to maybe sit it out for 6 months or a year and then go back, because staff does eventually turn over and you can get some real gems. And even if they leave the shop, you can follow them to their next, next.
Or even like I know we have a couple people that, you know, they've been doing this for a long time. So they can be a bit curmudgeon-y.
Yeah.
So maybe if you go in and you have that experience and it's in the afternoon, maybe go back in the morning, because you'll have a different shop staff and, you know, somebody else that you get to meet and deal with.
Yes. And then you can just call ahead. Like, I'll just call and say, is Jay in today? And if he's not in, then I don't go in. And if he's in, I go in. And it's funny, because I called the other day and a woman answered. And I felt so bad being like, hi, is Jay there? Because I felt like I was doing that thing. But it's just that I've got, you know, one specific person who knows exactly where I'm at in my journey and what my needs are for my situation. Those are great tips. Do you have a conservation issue that you're working on right now that you wanted to shout out before we hang up?
No, we're always working. We work with the Henry's Fork Foundation here. That's a tough job. They've got their hands full. It's such a hard thing with climate change, and people think they should be able to, you know, fix the river because the hatches aren't what they used to be, but they can't fix climate change. So I don't know. Be nice to your local nonprofit because they're doing their best.
Is the water quality changing there? Has the fishing been what it was, you know, 5, 10, 15 years ago?
No. I mean, and of course everything goes through cycles. But I've definitely noticed a difference in hatches. Definitely. Okay. Definitely.
How so?
The mayfly hatches aren't as just crazy prolific as they used to be. I remember going out in the evening and being in Spinner Falls. It was just like a cloud where you couldn't see. So I feel like, you know, those mayfly hatches have really changed. They're still there, but they're definitely changing. It's climate change. It's water temperatures. And what can you do about that? Except go vote, right?
I have no idea. I get this whole climate change thing, which we won't dive into now because I'm still relatively ignorant in the whole thing. But wow, it's conflicting. You know, you listen to Jordan Peterson on one hand, and then you're listening to Patagonia on the next. And I'm just sitting in the middle going, you know what? Maybe this is not a bad time to just be in the middle and listening to what everybody has to say. So yeah, if you have any stats or facts that will enlighten us, like by all means, go for it. Cause I wouldn't even know where to start on it.
No. That's probably for another.
But the hatches have changed. That's important to know because that's obviously going to impact. Does that impact how many fish there are at the end of the day or how big they're getting maybe?
Well, yes. Yeah. I mean, though, last summer, man, there were big fish being caught. I feel like it's slowed down for sure. People aren't maybe catching or seeing the numbers of fish that they were in the past. I think it has to have to do with the bug life, the hatches.
All right. What's next for you, Millie Paney?
Back to work. Summer's on its way, right?
It is.
And my kid's going to college, so I'm not sure.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. What an exciting time.
Right?
What a scary time.
Yeah. Exciting. I'm super excited for her. Very, very excited. And then my life will, whatever will happen with my life. I'm really just focused on the next step in her life.
Right. But it is a whole new chapter for you both.
Yes. Right. So, you know, not much is going to change. Trout Hunter is still up and going. So there's a lot of work to still be done there.
I have no doubt. All right. Well, I'll link everything up. Thank you for making the time. Is there anything that you would like to add or to ask me?
When are you going to come visit me?
Yeah. I'm going back to Montana in July. I should have factored it in.
We'll do it.
No, because I'm taking her to Disney or doing ICAST. Are you going to be going to ICAST? Okay. Yeah. Maybe the following year, because yeah, I've kind of skirted around you because I've done Wyoming with her. I've did Montana solo. I did Montana this year coming up. We need to come out your way, don't we?
Yeah, you really need to fish the Henry's Fork.
Yeah, I haven't. You know what? I've never fished the Henry's Fork. How does
That's
it compare?
Terrible. To, that is terrible.
How does it compare to Montana fishing?
So what did you fish? The Madison?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so, I fished the South Fork of the Snake. It's probably the closest I've been.
Okay. The South Fork is huge. So the Henry's Fork is the North Fork of the Snake. It's smaller, but it's still a good size. But we're a tailwater, so we get great hatches, and kind of what the Henry's Fork is known for is its dry fly fishing and its big rising fish. So a lot of dry fly fishing.
Yeah, right.
I don't know what you did on the Madison, but
probably not as much dry fly fishing as I would have liked. It wasn't the right time. I fished Silver Creek. Is it kind of like that as far as the fish quality goes?
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah. It's just a bigger Silver Creek.
Wow.
But that's very slow moving, peaceful water.
Sounds great.
I find like the Madison very noisy.
Yeah.
And I feel like I can't concentrate. It's probably because I can't stand up either because the rocks are so slick and I'm just trying to stand up, right? But yeah. It's like Silver Creek, very quiet, slow moving. And I love that. I love being able to hear a fish rise over here, over there. And
oh, that sounds so much more relaxing. Yeah. Well, it was fantastic to see you. And I can't believe it's been so long, but we'll have to do it again soon.
I know. Oh yeah. Maybe we should go climbing next time.
No. Were you, weren't you there in at that event in California, right?
And we went climbing together.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, hell no. I'm like, palms are sweating. I'm hanging onto the rock like a spider. And you're just like, see ya. And off you go. Bitch.
Oh my God. That was so funny.
Oh, yeah, to you. My palms are sweating right now. Just thinking about it. They're actually sweating. Ugh. No.
Okay. No climbing.
Are you still climbing?
No. I would if it was convenient and somebody was around.
Yeah.
But it's not that convenient around here. I can't just, run out and do it. So.
Gotcha. Fair enough.
No. I would if I could.
Well, look, it's been an absolute pleasure. I look forward to seeing you again soon. And how can people reach you if they've got questions or would like to reach the shop?
Trouthunt.com or Millie@trouthunt.com.
Beauty. All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Don't hang up.
Let's stay in touch too.
And that concludes this episode of Anchored. Thank you for listening.